Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hey, friends, welcome. Welcome. I hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, that you're having a great day. If you're not, just know that I hear you. I see you, and I'm praying for you for sure, but we're glad that you're here this hour. We have a great guest, as usual, for you. Today, I'm going to be talking with Connie Huber. Now, she is an associate professor at Liberty University's School of Health Sciences, and there she teaches a range of courses on global health, women's health, program planning and evaluation, contemporary issues in public health, and she has a very impressive degree of research interest. And when Connie and I had a conversation in planning for this show, there were so many things that we were talking about and so many ways that our scholarship is aligned. But she's done research on social policy, human rights, adolescent pregnancy prevention, all kinds of things. And currently, she is authoring a curriculum on the success sequence and developing an optimal health framework for women's health in Central America. And today we are really going to dive into relationships, and we'll talk about teen relationships and dating violence prevention, which has been a lot on the news and something that we're talking about a lot, and helping our kids to navigate in-person relationships in this digital age. It is a lot more complicated than thought it was. And I know for me as a mom of four, it is challenging for me to help my kids navigate what does this look like? How do they have those healthy in-person relationships when so much interaction is happening online? So Connie and I today are going to equip you to talk to your kids about what are healthy signs in a relationship and what are unhealthy signs in a relationship. And so I hope that this will help you as you help them navigate this, something that can cause a lot of conflict, a lot of discussion within families, and you can't see that person, and no, you can't go there, and what do we do? Well, those are all the things we'll dive into today. Connie, we're so glad to have you here on the show.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today and with your audience.
Well, I'd love for you just to, our audience to get to know you a little bit. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up where you are today teaching at Liberty?
I love that question. I get that question quite frequently. How did I end up at Liberty? And I would just say it was a series of saying yes to God. I spent the bulk of my career working at a pregnancy resource center where I did education, school-based education, talking about adolescent risk prevention, and just had no idea how from there God would lead me into some places, just little by little saying yes to the Lord when opportunity arose. I ended up working on a government contract, supporting grantees, doing absence education, school-based programming, which is where I gained a lot of the experience that I have that we're going to talk about today. Again, I found myself a little bit at a crossroads in my career when the administration changed and the goals of that contract changed from a government perspective. And for the first time in a while, Liberty was hiring in their public health department. I had been teaching online for them. And just about the time the door was closing on that contract I was on, the Lord had opened a door for this position at Liberty. So without ever having stepped foot on campus or even really ever being in Virginia, my husband and I moved across country, left our children and grandchildren and parents to come to Liberty. And so I arrived on campus on a Friday, walked around a little bit. It was the middle of the term and started teaching on Monday. And so be careful when you say yes to the Lord. You don't know where that's going to take you.
Well, we are so glad that you are there, and what a sacrifice, you know, really to do that. But the work that you're doing is really important in what families need today. And you and I had a conversation about this concept of relationship-based parenting. Now, it is a very common misconception among parents that they think their kids become teenagers and all of a sudden their voice doesn't matter. The parent voice doesn't matter. Kids don't care at all what I think. I can't get their face out of their phone. They only care what their friends think. And Connie, you and I both know that that is not backed up in research. And research shows very clearly that parental voice is the loudest, the most influential, and the one that matters the most. And it just honestly makes me sad and breaks my heart a little to see so many parents buying the lie that their voice doesn't matter and that they're struggling for that kind of power, influence, or control, and their kids, you know, don't care what they think. The truth is, our kids don't give us an immediate feedback loop to say, oh, yes, mother, oh, yes, father, your voice is so influential and comforting. Thank you so much. That's not how it works. But I would love for you to share your perspective on that and to encourage parents that their voice matters.
Jessica, if I could just provide a little bit of comic relief in the midst of this very intense topic, I would say that perhaps as parents, the challenge is that we don't speak teenager. We're not fluent in adolescent. I think that the thank yous come in eye rolling, hands on the hip, and maybe sound a little bit like stomping. So I think the thank you is there. I just think we need to become fluent in adolescence. I love that you brought that up. I think that parents throughout time, I started really this work in adolescent risk prevention in about 2004, and the data has remained clear over two decades that parents are the first and the most influential teachers and advocates for children. Research still shows that they are the strongest voice and the greatest predictor to risky behaviors. So I think I would add that it's having a clear and intentional message, making sure that we're communicating our value and sticking to that and not sending mixed messages. In sexual risk avoidance, one of the things that we discovered in a comprehensive literature review that was conducted was that if parents make a statement that they would like for their children to wait to engage in sexual activity till marriage, but yet provide birth control, that sort of mixed message is almost a predictor for the young person engaging in risky behaviors. So the parental voice is the strongest voice, but it must be intentional and consistent. And the key is really to talk early and talk often.
That's so true, because we hear, I mean, everybody knows, if I say this phrase, if I say the talk, there is no adult on earth that doesn't know exactly what that means. And you think back maybe to one instance that you had, but this is an ongoing conversation. You know, this is one rolling, years-long conversation that happens. And I said this in my show before and had some people write into me about it. Like the phrase that I use is being authentically awkward when we're talking about this, knowing that it doesn't really get easy. It's not really, you know, on our top list of things, you know, that's the best thing about being a parent. Like, we don't relish these conversations, but they're so important. And the thing is, Connie, if we don't lead in these conversations, the world will. Media will fill in the gap. Kids have access to information like they have never had before. And we know that if we don't fill in that narrative, that void of a narrative, they will find voices that will fill that in, even well-intentioned or not. And that can definitely happen. I want to talk a little bit about what you said, adolescent risk prevention. Now, for you and I as researchers, and you know, for me as a clinician, we talk about that a lot, but this is something, let's break that down a little bit and help parents understand that, you know, we as scientists, like, we don't want kids to take risk and to do stupid things. I mean, honestly, that's what we're talking about, right? And that's what we are seeing. So what are some of the kinds of things when you're looking at adolescent risk prevention, what are the things that you are seeing at the top of the list that are most common and most dangerous?
Well, first, I'd like to say that when we talk about risk prevention, we talk about healthy risk and really differentiating as a parent between what is a healthy risk, because we do want adolescents taking risk. We want those to be healthy risks. Someday they're going to need to put themselves out there and apply for a job and interview for a job. They're going to need to put themselves out there and take a risk and date at the appropriate time or say yes to a marriage or a proposal. So I think it's key to realize that there's healthy risk and safe risk, and we can really start to have those conversations about what that looks like, because life is a risk. And so just us coming to Virginia was a risk. And mm-hmm. How do we take risk and follow in healthy ways in, you know, providing that kind of adrenaline rush that adolescents look for? So I'd love to say that first. I would say second, one of the things that we see in terms of risk that a lot of parents are probably familiar with is social media, just what's happening in social media and exposure to explicit media, whether intentional or unintentional graphic images. Definitely see that on the rise and really shaping some of the ways that adolescents think about relationships. We also see that while sexual activity in teens and adolescent pregnancy is down, we do see that risk in relationships, in terms of unhealthy relationships, relationships that are started on social media platforms, kind of play down in a space where parents can't see, are on the rise. And then obviously drug use. And then I've been reading a lot recently about some of the things, the additives that can be put into vaping and juuling that can have a very negative impact. So we see those types of risk definitely on the rise.
Yeah. And those are things that I'm talking about a lot here. I think it's just good for parents to know that, yeah, those risks are real, and we can't adopt the not my kid mantra, like my kid would never, because sometimes when we give those messages like, oh, my kid would never, my kid is way smarter than that, you know, my kid, knows better than that. And then that can be hard because kids are kids. And let's talk a little bit, Connie, about the brain and how that works. You and I had a conversation about how the bottom line is their thumb moves faster than their prefrontal cortex, the part of their mm-hmm. brain that makes the executive decision making. And when we're talking about these risk taking on social media, there's a lot of times where kids will engage in behaviors. They will take unhealthy risks online, and parents immediately kind of jump to this, oh my goodness, they've violated their morals. They have abandoned their spiritual beliefs, and you know, this is a moral or spiritual issue. But what we know is that kids, it takes until their mid-20s for that to really develop. And so what I find is that a lot of times they're not really reasoning on that level. When they're thinking through this decision, when they're gauging their risk, they're not thinking at the level of their religious or moral beliefs. Honestly, a lot of times their thumb just moves faster than that. And what I find, Connie, is that a lot of times, you know, then we generalize that one decision, that one mistake into a character flaw. And we do this by using shaming language. And some cues that you mm-hmm. know that you're using shaming language are, you know, why are you always so? And when we start generalizing it, or why can you never? And we use these statements like, mm-hmm. you're so rude, you're so disrespectful, you're lazy, you're irresponsible, you're frustrating, you're such a pain. I mean, all of these things. But really what we mean in those moments is your choice today was inconsiderate of my schedule. The words you chose just now were disrespectful. The way you mm-hmm. treated your siblings in this situation was hurtful. Not following through on your commitment put an extra burden on someone else. Or the way that you're looking at me and rolling your eyes is rude. We need to be more instructive. In one case, we're saying, I don't like your behavior. But the other case, what we're really telling our kids is, I don't like you. That's really, really hard. Well, when we come back, Connie, I'm going to ask you to share with us about the five I's. You know, that's the letter I, not E-Y-E. We're going to talk about the five I's and looking for signs of concern in a relationship. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Why is our society so ravenous to abort babies? According to a former Satanist, the demonic forces have a bloodlust for the innocents and sickly believe their blood sacrifice empowers evil. Make no mistake, we are fighting a spiritual battle as we protect the most innocent among us, babies in their mother's womb. Preborn stands on the front lines of this battle, and their network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, often next to abortion mills where unspeakable evil takes place every day. Preborn offers God's love and life to protect hurting women and precious preborn babies. And every time a baby is saved, which happens 200 times a day, good conquers evil. Please make your most generous gift to empower good and rescue precious souls. For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound that doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome back. We are talking to Connie Huber. She is an associate professor at Liberty University's School of Health Sciences. And before the break, we were right in the middle of a discussion of how teen brains work. And I was talking about how to coach your children through a behavioral struggle without turning it into a character flaw. Because listen, our kids, we talked about this in the first segment, Connie and I did. Our voice as parents is the most powerful, the most influential in your lives. No matter what you think or perceive that importance to be, I promise you there is no voice more powerful than yours. And our kids' minds work like a police scanner, listening in the background very intently. They're developmentally wired to be very intent and focused on things that have to do with them. So especially when we're talking about them, they listen to what we say. And more importantly, they believe us. And so before the break, I was talking about the difference between a behavioral struggle and a character flaw. One approach is shame-based, while the other is grace-based. And one approach is fear-induced, but we're called to be faith-informed. And one of the greatest gifts we can give our kids is to reflect God's view of them in our eyes, to let them know there's always hope, there's always redemption, there's always a grace-filled path. So, Connie, I want to invite you to weigh in on this amygdala hijack and just the brain dynamics that go on sometimes when we think we honestly overestimate our kids' ability to reason through some situations. So what do you think about all of that?
I would love to share, just if I could, a technical term, and then, as you said, break that down. So in public health, we talk about primordial prevention. And primordial prevention is how do we prevent the risk before the risk even exists. So when we talk about talk often and talk early, that might be much earlier than what parents are thinking. And so you were talking about that, embracing the awkward, that it's just going to be awkward. I would kind of propose if we start very early, maybe even as early as toddlers. You know, God has designed his creation to show us all the things that we need. And so just, you know, even on a nature walk, you can kind of start setting up some of these conversations as your children see some of the things that the wildlife are doing, or at the zoo even. What are those animals doing? And just setting that up for, well, procreation, that's how they get their children. That's the mommy and the daddy, you know, just having these conversations where it just seems natural and placing sort of a value on that, that opens the door to have a very comfortable sort of conversation naturally about something that later will segue into those conversations with adolescents. So I would say take advantage, take intentional walks and, you know, talk about those things, what reproduces, what doesn't, maybe how. And in those conversations, talk about how a parent is treating the child. And so they're seeing that exampled in love and care, and these are natural things that happen. That will kind of take away some of that shame that, you know, this is, we observe this in nature. Speaking to the amygdala hijack, I think some of that could be primordial prevention too, if we think about intentional impulse control, like teaching them as toddlers delayed gratification. My daughter-in-law is wonderful with this with my three grandchildren. I've watched her at Christmas. She comes from a large family with birthday parties where she explains how, you know, we're going to get to that in just a minute. And, you know, teaching them really delayed sort of gratification. We're going to wait till everyone can sit down, or we're going to wait till after we share dinner, and that it's just going to be so special and fun. And so really, this is setting the stage for when they're adolescents. It gives you a comfortable way to talk about things. You know, we'd like to see you delay gratification and wait until you're married to engage in activity. You have a story to build on. Remember all those Christmases when we were talking about controlling our impulses and waiting and delaying gratification? Just gives you some springboard. So I would say that it starts early. It starts often with very intentional teaching regulation of emotions, teaching delayed gratification and controlling those impulses and how to distract in healthy ways. What are some healthy ways that we can engage? And what are some healthy ways that we could even engage in risk through sports and opportunities like zip lining or, you know, fun activities that are in that context of, you know, giving the amygdala what it wants with a little bit of the adrenaline, but in controlled and safe situations.
Yes. And I think, you know, having that open door for conversation, this is something I talk about a lot. And I frequently will tell my kids, you know, you can always tell me anything. And I say it so much, they roll their eyes. Yes, Mom, we know, mm-hmm. We can always tell you anything. But just for, like you said, from those early stages, looking at things like regulating their emotions and delayed gratification, it is applicable in so many risk-taking situations, whether that's intimate relationship risks, whether that is social media risk, whether that is experimenting with substances or alcohol, all of those things. If you look at it, you're teaching them lessons over time. And the honest truth is, Ghani, these are things that we still struggle with as adults, regulating our emotions and delaying gratification. I mean, I know I can give you a lot of examples in my own life where I think, oh, do I really need that right now? But I want it. And we have that. Yeah. So we have to have that same kind of patience with our kids. And the other thing that you and I both know is that when kids are in unhealthy relationships, that is where their risk for risk-taking behaviors is going to just skyrocket. It can amplify and elevate so quickly. And I have talked with so many families who feel like things are going along, everything's going, you know, relatively well, not perfect, of course, but just relatively well. And enter one destructive relationship, enter one person in their life who can just so quickly develop a bond. And we can see from the outside, like, this is not good. This is not, you know, a healthy relationship, but it's hard for them to see that. And so then what I see parents do is say, well, you can't text that person. You can't contact that person. You can't be with that person. And then all of a sudden this power struggle is there. And, you know, I mean, I'm talking just a matter of weeks down the road, they can think, what happened? And so you're working on a framework that you're calling the five I's, like the letter I, how to recognize unhealthy signs of relationships. Let's just talk about those first, and then we'll talk about how parents can point those out to their kids in a way that's effective and healthy.
Sure. I would love to set this up first by saying, in my two decades of working with this, one of the most common things that I hear from parents is this is difficult to talk about. And sometimes it's because parents will feel like hypocrites. Maybe they've not made the best decisions or they've not modeled the best things in their life. And so they feel a little hypocritical in talking about these things. I would propose that those who have experienced it are those who have kind of a platform, you know, to talk about. So I just would encourage parents to, regardless of what their decisions have been or what their past has looked like, don't let that stop you from speaking to your children, because, again, you are the influential voice for children. And if they don't hear that from you, where are they going to hear that? And I would say that many teens have a very unrealistic view of what dating looks like. And it's often based on what they've seen online, YouTube, TikTok, movies. I would say the opposite ends of the spectrum are probably Hallmark movies, which are somewhat unrealistic in the way dating goes. And on the other end of the spectrum, maybe teen Netflix or YouTube videos. And so oftentimes, the teen doesn't have a really good understanding of what that looks like. And teens, as you know, Jessica, in their stage of development with their identity, they're starting to develop their own personal identity away from their family. So they're exploring what is happening in the world. And if these images are the only thing they're getting and the conversation is not counter, it can really set them up for failure in relationships. So I encourage parents to really talk about it and talk about it from comparisons. I am shocked at Liberty how often my students say their parents never really told them anything about how to have a healthy relationship. So this framework that I'm working on is really about something I call a relationship wheel, and it's based on the power and control wheel. And so I have broken down the components of an unhealthy relationship or the unhealthy relationship wheel and have adapted that from the power and control wheel into five I's. And recognizing these or staying in tune to these, and then I'll give you the counter for the healthy relationship, which I call equity, inclusion, and sharing to make it easy for people to remember. But if parents will think about these, they're cyclic in nature. When a relationship is unhealthy, it's cyclic in nature and can kind of accelerate over time. So just having an understanding of the cycle of things can really help parents have conversations with their young people at what to look for, and can also give parents kind of a view of what it looks like when it's unhealthy, because sometimes we have a tendency to diminish, or like you said previously, not my child. So the first step is intensity, like an intriguing introduction. Typically, we would call abuser in an unhealthy relationship, or the aggressor, quickly becomes very serious, wants to spend an inappropriate amount of time together very quickly. There's just a lot of intensity, whether it's a charismatic kind of intensity or if it's an aggressive kind of intensity. Anytime that it just feels like it's a heightened amount of anything. So looking for intensity very early on. Next would be intimidation. The next step we would sort of see that intriguing introduction or that intensity that's building would be followed next with this intimidation that makes the person feel not comfortable with sharing their opinion, not saying anything contrary to the aggressor. Whatever the other person wants or feels, they go along with. Sometimes that's things they feel forced to do. Following intimidation, we would see the next step would be isolation. This is when they become the only person that abuser wants to hang out with. And so they're isolating from friends and family. don't want them to hang out with anyone else. Don't really want to come around the family, don't want to be in group settings, and everything is just kept between the two. And sometimes, Jessica, this can be tricky, because even in a group setting, like maybe a youth group at church, this might, you know, they might be there in the group setting, but they're cutting the person off from the pack, if you will, mm-hmm. wanting them all to themselves. Next, this would be followed by insisting, where they refuse to see the other person's viewpoint. They become more demanding. There's some action or activity that they want the other person to do that the other person may not be willing to. This is where we might see things like sexting or other types of activity that person begins to insist upon having their way, whether it's drugs, alcohol, vaping, sexting, you know, anything that person, even to the viewpoint of that person, just insisting and demanding having their way. And then lastly, this is the part that becomes more visible. There's an incident. Could be a threat, could be words, could be gestures, could be physical abuse, could be even sexual intimacy. An incident will occur. And then that abuser will follow up with a, I'm sorry. And then we start right back to the beginning, where it's an intriguing drawing in, I won't do that again. And we see that start, that cycle starting all over. At first, this could be slow and take a good amount of time for these to emerge, 6 months to a year. Sometimes at the incident, when the abuser gets what they want, they walk. But sometimes it's an I'm sorry, and we get back on the wheel again. So if parents can be in tune to these types of behaviors that are indicative of an unhealthy relationship, they can bring intervention before things get intense, before the incident where somebody might be harmed.
I think that's a really important point, Connie, because you've talked about primordial prevention and preventing before risk occurs. And a lot of times, as a defensive strategy for parenting, we think about, okay, how do we cut out this, you know, unhealthy influence? How do we eliminate this unhealthy relationship? But I want to flip the paradigm, just like you and I have been doing this whole show, and talk about, how do you cultivate positive relationships? Because that is really important and really powerful. So say that you have a kid who is connected in church, who has a good relationship with their healthcare provider, who has a good group of friends, who has other adults already in their life who they know and trust. It is going to be a lot harder for an aggressor, an abuser, somebody who is just going to initiate an unhealthy relationship, it's going to be a lot harder for that person to gain influence and control than a teen who is feeling isolated and unheard and unseen and unloved and misunderstood. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the flip side of this and how we can help cultivate healthy relationships, because parents, we need this more than ever, especially at the age where our kids are living at the speed of a smartphone. We'll be right back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, welcome back to my conversation with Connie Huber, Associate Professor at Liberty University's School of Health Sciences. And we are talking all things relationship today and how you can leverage a healthy relationship with your kids to prevent risk-taking behaviors. Now, before the break, Connie shared with us the five I's, that's the letter I, of that are signs that parents should be concerned about an unhealthy relationship. Those I's were intensity, intimidation, isolating, insisting until there's an incident, and I'm sorry, and either the relationship ends and the carnage continues, or the cycle starts all over again. And I was talking to you about how it's so important for us to not only have a defensive strategy, but to have an offensive strategy to cultivate healthy friendships with our kids. So before we go into that and I go back to my conversation with Connie, let me ask you about being the hangout house. Are you a hangout house? What do I mean by that? Is your house known as the place to hang out for your teen and their friends when kids are looking for somewhere to go? Is your house first on the list? Teens need a safe and comforting space to simply be. And here's the thing, we as parents, honestly, we often tell ourselves some lies about why kids don't hang out at our house. We think, well, my house isn't big enough. My house isn't nice enough. Like, well, we aren't set up to entertain, or so-and-so has fill in the blank of everything else that someone else has and that you don't. Or we think, I'm not the cool parent. Like, kids don't want to come here. The truth is that you don't need the nicest house, or you don't need to be the coolest parent to be an inviting host. And so, you know, one of the things that I did with my kids was flip the script on them asking if people can come over. Instead, my husband and I did something pretty radical, and we gave them an open invitation to invite people over unless we told them otherwise. So for example, we would say, you know, your grandma's visiting on Tuesday, so let's keep the house quiet, no visitors that day. But alleviating that kind of pressure and awkwardness, let me tell you, it got my kids out of a lot of situations where I think they might have felt pressure to go somewhere else. They'd say, they knew they could just immediately say, let's go to my house instead of having to wonder, where are we going to go? How am I going to get out of this? They just say, who wants to come to my house? The other thing you can do is open up your fridge and your pantry. I mean, honestly, just pop some food in the oven. If you cook it, they will come. I promise. They will, all of a sudden, you will have this group of kids around your island and they want to talk to you. Don't worry about being messy. I promise you, kids don't care. They don't care if they sit on the floor. They don't care if your bed's made. They don't even care if your bathroom is dirty and you don't have the guest soap and the hand towels out. They don't care. Be real and just invite them into your family space. So if you're doing a puzzle, if you're playing a game, if you're watching a show, if you're playing basketball in the driveway, if you're going on a walk, just invite them to join in. Don't feel pressured to entertain them or provide some sort of glitzy or expensive entertainment. Engage them in conversation. Just ask how they're doing. Ask them what's going on with them. Teens appreciate that care. And again, just embrace the awkward. Even if you feel awkward, just do it. And those are some of the ways that we can protect our kids and provide some protective factors to protect them against some of these unhealthy relationships. Because like I said before the break, we have this built-in protective hedge that will speak truth to them, that will say, hey, I don't know about this person for you. You know, are you looking at how you're acting when you're around them? Those things can be really important, and asking those questions, because the real way you can tell if a relationship is healthy is by looking at how that person is. Like, do they bring out the best in you? So Connie, let's go to the flip side of these five I's. What are the ways that we can see that are healthy signs in a relationship? Because just as much as we want as parents to call out unhealthy signs in a relationship, we need to be very intentional about calling out those healthy things and saying, hey, I see this in your friendship and I really like that. That's something to look for. What are those healthy things?
Absolutely. I love what you just shared about at the home. I can testify to that. My children are grown now, but I certainly know that a good part of the adolescent years, our home was under construction. We were in a remodel project, but it didn't stop the young people from wanting to hang out. The comfort that they feel is really in the relationship, not in the structure. And so I think kind of keeping that in perspective is that if we're really parenting from a relational standpoint, it's that relationship, even with you as a parent, they may be seeking. And so that environment in the home relationally is what's going to draw them. So good advice. If I could even take this, again, I call these five the equity, inclusion, and sharing. And we certainly hear about that a lot. And so I thought that might be an easy way to remember. But if I could start kind of with the primordial approach that preventing the risk before the risk is present, and then I'll move into when the risk is present. But I think one of the ways to think about talking early and talking often to prevent the risk on the front end is, even as toddlers and young children, starting to think about boundaries and respect within the home. Are there safe places and times that are kind of sacred, where there's respect amongst siblings? If a sibling is doing their homework and another child is frustrating them or trying to engage them, is there boundaries in place? Is that a sacred time? If someone in the family needs quiet time or privacy, are children taught to respect? So I think boundaries, again, are something that can be taught very early, even in nature, on a nature walk, talking about the boundaries and territories of animals and communicating that in God's creation, each and everything requires its own space and privacy and boundaries in order to thrive. I kind of have a funny story about this, something that I've taught that goes along with the five I's and the equity, inclusion, and sharing is something called rules of engagement. So I think understanding the rules of a game before you start to play it are vital. One of the ways we could teach children this is to go out and start playing, you know, a very familiar game to them and playing not according to the rules. And then obviously we know people are going to get upset. Then you can say, well, it's very important that we know the rules of a game before we start playing, because I think this translates to relationships and setting up boundaries and ensuring that everybody knows the rules of the game before we start engaging. This can be good for house rules, too. But kind of a funny example I have is when my daughter and son-in-law were first married, we were playing Monopoly, and my family doesn't like to play Monopoly with me. I'm quite competitive. But we had gotten the cheater version of Monopoly, which exists. And so my family and I sit down. I don't like to read the rules, really, so I didn't start by reading the rules. My son-in-law had the rules. And so we start playing, and I'm playing very competitively according to the rules that I thought should be in place for cheating. And when my son-in-law corrected me by reading the rules and said, no, he calls me mom. No, mom, you can't do that. Well, I am embarrassed to say I behaved quite badly when it didn't go my way. I found myself having to apologize. I kind of redeemed myself the next year for Christmas when I saw the sore loser version of Monopoly and bought that for my son-in-law. But it opened this dynamic of conversation of how absolutely important it is in a family, in any relationship, that we really understand what the rules are, that we don't sit down and engage when everybody is not on the same page with what the rules are, what the boundaries are. And so I think it's very important to teach our young people that, just like playing Monopoly, engaging in a relationship could be a game for somebody. And it could be a game they don't want to engage in if they've not communicated what those rules are. Again, if they've seen things on TikTok, YouTube, they might have their idea of what dating is and mimic that without a full understanding of what the rules of the game are. So I think it's important to use each of these things that we do in teaching relationship skills. And so that being said, in this healthy relationship wheel, it is powered by, the wheel is powered by or driven by equity and sharing and inclusion. It's also powered by knowing the rules of the game before you begin. So teaching your young people how to communicate their boundaries, how to share in a relationship what it is that they expect. And so the component of this wheel start with E, S, and I. So equity, sharing, and inclusion. So if the audience has some ideas of how I can name this like the five I's, I would welcome that. But
this is the work of a professor, for sure. We're constantly revising.
It's a work in progress, but even though it's in progress, I found it worth sharing. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. Mm-hmm. But the components of this wheel are establish, safety, engaging, listening, which will ultimately result in interaction. So let me compare it to the five I's. So step one in this is to establish versus intensity. So in the unhealthy, we saw an intense, driven, everything heightened and moving quickly. In a healthy relationship, there's time to establish boundaries, time to establish expectations, time to really establish that relationship by getting to know one another. I've read that it takes 400 hours voice to voice or face to face to really get to know somebody. And so it can take quite a bit of time. If it was 1 hour a day, it would take a little bit more than a year. So in a healthy relationship, both people are taking time to establish the relationship, to get to know each other. Next is safety versus intimidation. Intimidation causes fear or threat, and that's somebody having power over you. In this situation, there's safety. Safety to share your opinion, safety to share your ideas, safety to share your dreams. It feels like a safe place, much like that home that you communicated, the hangout home. It's a safe place. You get to express what you want and how you feel. And that's important, and it's important to the other person. Number three is inclusion, so inclusion versus isolation. In a healthy relationship, a person is okay with spending time with your family, spending time with your friends. The person is okay with you spending time with others, and they want you to be included with others, and they want to be included with others. And so all parties are welcome in this relationship. Next is sharing or listening, and this is taking time to really listen, to hear the other person, and this is versus insisting. In an unhealthy, somebody won't listen to the other opinion. In a healthy relationship, that sharing is really listening to understand and not listening to form an answer, active listening. Five is interaction versus incidents. And so if we follow one through four, we take time to establish their safety, inclusion, and sharing. This ultimately leads to healthy, positive interactions. And then just as the other has an I'm sorry, really paying attention to if someone can ask for forgiveness when it's necessary, do they have an ability to say I'm sorry? Because that's very important in a relationship as well.
Connie, those are so helpful. And I think something that you said is really important is that our kids do have an unrealistic expectation of what friendships and what romantic relationships should look like. You talked about, I mean, we've got, 50, well, I won't even go there, but we have movies that we would, I think, most all agree that are not appropriate for our kids to base their relationships on, all the way to, you know, these fairy tale romances. And the reality is somewhere in the middle. And I think we need to be intentional as parents in teaching our kids what healthy relationships look like. I know I do this with my kids, even with my husband, and saying, hey, you saw us bickering earlier. I need you to see us say, I'm sorry. We bickered in front of you. We need to say, I'm sorry in front of you, so you can see us making that right and know that in a healthy relationship, there will be conflict, but there is also grace. Now, listen, as we go, I think there's five people that every teen needs in their life. They need an intercessor. They need someone they can text or call to pray for them at any time. They need a counselor, someone who's a generous listener and spiritually sound and dependable for wise advice.
They need a healthcare provider they know and that you trust. They need one of your friends who's willing to invest in them. And they need someone who's in the same boat, somebody who is going through the same thing that they are and can relate, and they don't feel alone. Now, listen, we have to be intentional, and I hope that this has been helpful for you in looking at the ways that we can cultivate those healthy relationships in our kids' lives. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.